Hey everybody, welcome back to One Club Shorts Podcast. It is officially over. The 2023 One Club Shorts season has officially wrapped. We had a great event at Morris County Golf Club on Tuesday. Weather was awesome for October. It felt like the middle of the summer. It was almost 80 degrees, if not 80 degrees exactly. Course played unbelievable. We had almost a full house. It was just, it was great. It was just so much fun to be out there with that group. There's a lot of new faces for that part of Jersey. So we're growing every event. We're getting more and more new people. So we've got our, you know, core group of returning customers, but a lot of new people to each one of these things, which is so fun. So with that said, it's, you know, also kind of wrapping up the Major League golf season as well. We have a little bit of Ryder Cup stuff to talk about. We'll talk about Lexi's dipping her toes into the men's competition in the coming weeks. And then we're going to talk football. I know Will's itching to talk about his beatdown on poor Duke, but we'll see how that goes. And luckily, I don't have any NFL teams that I'm really excited about. So, yeah. We'll figure something to talk about. Maybe the Bills, Glenn. That'd be a good one to hit on.
Yeah, Bills.
They gave us a lot to discuss, but we got to start with the Ryder Cup. So we all picked the U.S. to win or retain the cup. And I knew it was against my better judgment when I did it. I think we all kind of had that suspicion. And the Ryder Cup in Europe went the way that Ryder Cups in Europe go. It was basically over in the morning on Thursday or on Friday, which is embarrassing. By the end of the Friday foursomes round, Data Golf had the US's win probability under 20%. And by the time Sunday singles started, it was 5%. So they really never had a chance. And it was an embarrassing performance out of a group that needed to be better. And, you know, we'll get into, you know, for whom things went well and for whom things went particularly poorly. But Glenn, the question that I want to start with that I have for you that I cannot wrap my head around: why does the US suck at foursomes? We never play well in that format at all. I think at Whistling Straits, it was even like a tie or something. Like, why? Why does this happen? Why can't we get together a group of players that can competently play foursomes?
That's the question for all time for the U.S. at the Ryder Cup. I don't understand it. I don't know if they're such individuals that, you know, they're only good at playing their own ball. But yeah, it's just crazy the way we can't, you know, getting off to that 0-4 start was just, you couldn't come back from that. I don't know, but this whole Ryder Cup was just so weird. I can't explain any of it other than no one showed up to play.
Yeah, it was so emotionless, right? The whole first 2 days, it was just like we were going through the motions and they were just coming out guns blazing. And that's the one thing we all said is if the U.S. is going to be in trouble, if they don't come out hot and they let Europe get a little bit of momentum, it's over. And that's exactly what happened. They literally got caught sleeping. You know, I think they thought they were going to walk their way through some of this. I don't really know what happened, but whatever it was just too insurmountable to catch up. Because, you know, the fun part about the Ryder Cup is you see these guys taking shots that they don't normally take because the risk is so minimal in the sense of, hey, I can just go play the next hole, right? It's not going to compound, you know, from hole to hole to hole and over 4 days. Like, they're just, these short matches just let them go pin hunting all the time. So we're seeing these spectacular shots, and part of it's hard to fault the U.S. team to a certain degree, because that first day there were some of the greatest shots like I've seen in a long, long time. There were just chip-ins from all over the place, putts that were just never heard of. It was insane. So that barrage was just almost hold on for dear life, and then maybe things calm down, and it did a little bit. It was just too much. Day two needed to be much different for them to have a shot, and they couldn't. And they had it. They just couldn't put it away. That's what's more disappointing than anything else. They just they had a chance to crawl the way back in, make day three super interesting, and they just couldn't put day two away to make it, you know, square up a little bit.
It's terrible. Like you said, it was lifeless. Our most fiery player was Joe LaCava. I think he was the only one that cared. Like crazy that those guys came in and just, you know, I don't know. I just felt like they were emotionless, you know, except for really Cantlay and Max Homa. Like, I don't know, and Brian Harman. They were our three best players. Everybody else was just going through the motions. I feel like they didn't even want to be there.
I feel like Ricky almost wasn't part of the team. Like, it just, you know, he played that match in the beginning, didn't do great, and then just never even heard or saw him again. You know, by the time I know he played in the Sunday match, but it was almost everything was just almost kind of irrelevant. There wasn't one or two. Max was the one player that you're just like, man, this guy is on fire. But everyone else was just. Spieth was probably the worst golf I've seen him play collectively in a long, long time. I don't know how many times Justin Thomas you heard, well, his partner's out of the hole, so he's on this one. He's on his own on this one. You know, it's just time and time again. There's only so much you can do to any player to go one on two versus players of that caliber with that much momentum. It's just too much.
Spieth was miserable. He grades out by the data golf strokes gained as the second worst player in the tournament, but the worst on strokes gained tee to green by far. He just edges out Wyndham Clark for being the worst player in the tournament. And having him paired with Justin Thomas was pretty tough. And look, JT really grinded to get a half point and played a little bit of good golf at certain times during the week. But Jordan Spieth, like, you couldn't have paired him with Patrick Cantlay, who they had as the best U.S. player by strokes gained, and gotten anything out of him. I mean, for of all the times for him to lay an absolute egg, this was a pretty bad one. I mean, 100-yard shots that he was missing the green by 20 yards. He could not drive the ball for the life of him. You know, it was just a really, really bad performance and just disappointing to see. You know, I think as far as when you look at the stats, whether you look at it by record or you look at it by strokes gained, the fact that you get to the bottom of the list and there's Xander and Morikawa and Spieth and Ricky and, you know, JT is down there as well. Like, that's a formula for failure for this U.S. team. And I don't know why it happened, but those guys have to be the leaders. Like, Max Homa played a great Ryder Cup. Patrick Cantlay took at least one hard luck loss, but played a very good Ryder Cup. That's it. Like, there is one guy on the U.S. team who came out of this with a winning record, and that's Max Homa. And good for him, but with all due respect to Max Homa, you cannot put that group of players together and have Max Homa be the best one. You're going to get crushed, and that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, Spieth has never been a great ball striker. He wins because of his putter. So if you're shaky as a ball striker and you're going into the Ryder Cup without your A game, and especially on an away game, it's just going to get amplified. And I think all those guys, JT, you saw they were struggling. I think you got to go back to Zach's picks. He should have picked Keegan Bradley. You know, there's other guys there that were playing Lucas Glover. There are guys that were playing. I realized, you know, he went with the buddy group, got it. You know, probably pressure from the guys. Hey, we got to keep these guys together. This is the heart of the team. But at the end of the day, it bit you in the ass, and you should have had DJ. You should have had Bryson DeChambeau. You probably should have had Patrick Reed.
Okay, Glenn, I'm gonna challenge you on that one. Brooks Koepka is playing far better golf than any of the live guys you just mentioned, and he and Scottie Scheffler teamed up to take the worst loss in Ryder Cup history. So I find it hard to believe that if you made six different captain's picks, regardless of who they are, like I think this was doomed for failure from the beginning, but with nothing about Brooks Koepka's performance suggested to me that anyone else from LIV was showing up and saving this team.
I think I disagree. I mean, you're talking about one guy. This is a 12-man team. You got guys that had 0 points. You got guys that squeaked out a point here and there. You can't tell me that DJ and Bryson DeChambeau and Patrick Reed would have each got shut out or only 1 point. They're good players. I just disagree. I think you can point to one or two and, you know, be mad about Liv, but those guys should have had a look. We went in there with a weak team and we got our asses kicked because of it.
I don't think there's anything about Brooks Koepka having negative strokes gained and going 1-1-1 and having that loss be the worst loss in Ryder Cup history. And he was playing by far the best golf of any of the Liv guys you mentioned. Like,
DeChambeau was playing better than at the end. DJ was coming along. Brooks played good in the middle of the season, but it's a hot hand. That's why you get the 6 picks. You got to go with the hot guys at the end. Can't let your ego. You can't let friendships. You can't let anything go, but who are the hottest guys when the day that you were making those picks? And it doesn't matter if you like the tour they're playing on or not. If you're picking the guys that aren't the hottest, you're putting out a bad product and you got your ass kicked because of it.
So should Zach Johnson not have taken Justin Thomas?
No, he definitely shouldn't have taken Justin Thomas. Justin Thomas has been a disaster since most of the year, really. Definitely not. I would have taken DJ over Justin Thomas. I would have taken DeChambeau over Justin Thomas. I would have taken Keegan Bradley or Lucas Glover, any of those guys. I mean, even like, even picking Sam Burns. Like, yeah, Sam Burns started out hot, but he was terrible since May. But he's Scottie Scheffler's best buddy, so you pick him. So you lost because you picked based on the buddy system.
Okay, so that's
drinking and swimming, but not for the Ryder Cup.
That's something I want to get to as well, because – they picked guys based on the buddy system, whether it was Sam Burns for Scottie Scheffler or, whatever. But then they broke up the pairings that we're used to seeing. Friday morning, Burns and Scottie play together. Xander and Cantlay play together. Friday afternoon, you send Scottie back out, but now he's with Brooks Koepka, and you send Xander back out, but now he's with Morikawa. Saturday morning, you send Scottie and Scheffler back out again. They get crushed. Then you reunite Xander and Cantlay. They lose. You switch Max Homa from playing with Wyndham Clark to playing with Brian Harman, which was a good move, but like, then Saturday afternoon, you keep Homa and Harman consistent. Now you make this like Franken team of Sam Burns and Morikawa, and you have Cantlay and Clark together. Like, where was the consistency? I at least thought the fact that JT and Spieth are the only pairing that they never played with anyone else, I thought that was super weird. Like, Craig, what I interpreted that as ZJ just grasping at straws and looking for something and making desperate moves. Did you see any rhyme or reason there?
I think, in the very beginning, I can't imagine how much pressure he's under being that captain in that spot. But you dug yourself a hole by bringing the people that you brought. You can't change that halfway through. So you put your first team out there, and when they get absolutely shellacked like they did, now all of a sudden you probably start to go in a little bit of panic mode, right? It's like, okay, well then who's my hot hand? Okay, great. And he didn't seem to be panicking, but I think some of these seemed like panic moves. And the one group that needed to get split up, you got to bench Spieth. I hate to say it, JT is not the reason that those teams lost. He was the only one keeping them somewhat into it. He didn't play phenomenal, but he was the one keeping them at least somewhat close on some of these, in some of the matches. Spieth should have been sat if he's like, man, he's just not here right now. Let's figure out something else. I don't know. Some of the moves seem to be a little bit of desperation. Some of them seem to be a little bit of, hey guys, what do you want to do? We're all good buddies. There wasn't anything that I sat down with and I looked at and I'm like, oh, that makes perfect sense. There wasn't a lineup, by the way, that when I saw the opening lineup for day one, I was like, man, that's really odd. That's not the groupings I would have picked for day one coming out of the gates, but I don't know, what the hell do I know? It's so easy to second guess everything. So everyone's going to seem like a genius at this point. But I don't know. I don't think it was very well managed from Jump Street. So
yeah, like Mike Tyson said, everyone has a plan to get punched in the mouth. And then I think that 0-4 start on Friday morning was the punch to the mouth to Zach Johnson. I don't think he ever recovered mentally. And we're the team. Just, I think they just thought, wow, we're done. It just seemed like they were just done.
And I don't know if these stories are true or not, but you hear all these stories about like three or four of the guys didn't do any of the practice rounds. You know, some really haven't competed then for, you know, what seemed like 30 plus days, where the European team was there. They were together. They were competing. They knew the course in and out. They were just, they felt like, hey, we're not going to lose this thing, where the U.S. was like, yeah, hey, we'll give it our best shot and hopefully things fall our way. But, you know, I don't know. You never know what's true about divide in the locker room. If anything, the reporting has gotten so bad that it's tough to trust anything. But with that said, they sure didn't look like they were unified. They didn't look like they were, you know, ready to go out there and conquer the world by any means. They looked like they were just out there going through the motions, which kind of sucked.
In fairness to the team, they've all come out and said, like, in so many words, that's BS. But yeah. I agree. If you're talking about appearances, you nailed the way it looked.
Yeah.
I gotta say, there's nothing from this Ryder Cup that I'm more disappointed in than the performances of Scottie Scheffler and Xander Schauffele. I mean, for guys who are supposed to be two of the few best players in the world to come out and be absolute non-factors, you know, combining to go 1-5-2, that's terrible. Scottie Scheffler to go out there and not win a match, and again, I'll keep harping on it, take the worst defeat in Ryder Cup history when he's playing with a reigning major champion. Like, those guys should be embarrassed. To the extent that they care about the Ryder Cup, and I do believe that these guys care about the Ryder Cup, that was an unacceptably bad performance from the guys who should be the two best players on this U.S. team. And you look at the European team and, you know, who played really well for them? Oh, Rory McIlroy, 4-1-0. Victor Hovland just won the FedEx Cup, 3-1-1. John Rahm, 2-0-2. Like, the fact that Tyrrell Hatton had a better Ryder Cup than anyone on the U.S. team is an embarrassment. And if you are particularly Scottie Scheffler or Xander Schauffele, you got to take a hard look in the mirror at the way that you absolutely gave this one away. Because I honestly, Glenn, I don't buy that they went over there with a weak team. I think on paper, the team with, you know, the team that the U.S. brought top to bottom is stronger than one that ends with Ludvig Åberg and Shane Lowry and Sepp Straka and Nikolai Højgaard. I really believe that. And they got
proved that wrong.
they got outclassed. They got completely outclassed. But I think that a lot of it has to do with the fact that the U.S. brought some guys over who they thought would be absolute killers, and those guys didn't deliver. Like, and there's no reason Scottie Scheffler should get outclassed by Tyrrell Hatton.
Scheffler on 18 on Sunday was prime example. You're up by one. You need the point. All you need to do is get up and down from where you are, and he chips it over the green, has to come back. You know, Rahm makes an incredible putt, you know, wins the hole. But it's like those little things add up, right?
Yeah.
Like, we just didn't have that killer instinct, and they definitely did. You know, like when Rahm's standing over a putt from 30 feet away, you're thinking, wow, there's a really good chance he's going to make it. When we're 6 feet away, we're like, oh, God, we're going to miss this. Like, that's just like the mentality that they just – that momentum means a lot in any sport, but especially in golf. I don't know. You knew we were in trouble when the practice round happens and all you hear about is Victor Hovland's hole in one in the par four. We're like, this is going to be a long 4 days.
And it was very much a sign of things to come.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we talked about it before. It's like, you asked me, what's the story if the U.S. lose? And I said that their top three beat our top three, and their top three wiped the world with our top three.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, one of the funniest things about this Ryder Cup is 16.5 to 11.5, a 5-point margin is – like it's tied for the closest that we've had post Medina. 2014 at Glen Eagles was 16.5 to 11.5, but then we had 17-11, 17.5, 10.5, and 19.9. Like, I, as interesting as the Ryder Cup is, and as much credit as the U.S. team should get for keeping eyeballs on it by making some of the singles matches a little bit interesting, and, you know, not losing in the first four matches, which I was convinced they were going to do on Sunday. This tournament has a competition problem. And the team that goes on the road gets waxed. And that's what's happened each time for the last five Ryder Cups. And frankly, as bad as this one went for the U.S., I think no one would be surprised if, you know, they win the upcoming one at Bethpage, like 18 to 10. I don't think that would be weird at all. I'd be surprised if you guys think it is. So, Glenn, you know, what do you do about this? Because I think we all want the Ryder Cup to be 14.5 to 13.5, like it was at Medina and Celtic Manor, the edition prior. Is there anything we can do systematically or with course setup or with the governance of this thing to make it more competitive? Why, what is it about it that lends it to ending in blowouts all the time?
I just think more than anything, it's a sport. It's an event of momentum. You either get the momentum early and you keep it. It's hard to come back. I know the U.S. did it, and the Europeans have done it in recent years, but those are outliers. It's just, you know, it just comes down to they just hit better shots. There's no practice. These guys can hit every shot. These guys can play every course. They can play every type of grass. They can do it all. It just comes down to who wants it more. And that's it. And who's going to hit the clutch shots? Who's going to get the chip in here and there in the first couple of days and make the long bomb putts? They're going to win. But I think, you know, thank God this is going to Bethpage in 2025. If it was going to Hazeltine or Medina, no one would watch. But yeah, Everyone's going to tune in to see what the New York fans do to the Europeans. And it's going to be a New York market, so it's going to be huge. I think if it wasn't going to Bethpage, it would probably be a record low interest in the Ryder Cup in 2025. But thank God it's going to the place where fans are not afraid to express their feelings about the other one team or the other.
So building on that, Glenn, did the European fans lay the groundwork with the way they treated Patrick Cantlay for their guys to get absolutely attacked at Bethpage, you think?
I mean, it happens at both times. You know, everyone whines about it when you're the away team, but then the next year you're our fans are the best, you know, when they're doing the heckling. You know, that whole thing with Joe LaCava and Rory, I think Rory overreacted. Joe LaCava was never near his line. Yeah, he was being a little obnoxious, but wouldn't you be too if you just took 5 hours of out-and-out abuse to you and your player that you're there guarding, you're trying to help him, trying to, you know, make sure he doesn't have rabbit ears hearing everything he's saying? If I was Joe LaCava, he was probably 10 seconds away from going into the crowd just throwing haymakers. You know, he just got abused for 5 hours. Yeah, he celebrated a little bit too long. He injected himself into it. But, you know, at the same time, the caddies are part of it. They're a team out there. And, you know, he was defending his guy. But, yeah, I thought he should have gone and just punched some people. But he handled it with class, just waving the hat around and getting in Rory's face.
Rory's got to be careful, too. He's got to remember – he is not an NFL linebacker. He's a 5-foot-something, 100-pound-something golfer. Like, I get it. You're in good shape, and you can ride a Peloton for a good 20 miles if you want. But, like, getting in that fight in the parking lot, getting in, like, all right, cool your jets a little bit. Like, it's just – it's relaxed. Like, you're enough of the tough guy routine. Just,
and you're winning by 5.
Yeah, exactly. Like, just,
okay. He's been on the other side. He's one that I can't hear you. I can't hear you.
I think Rory's got to be really careful to settle down a little bit because I think people are starting to get a little tired of his antics and his complaining. Like this was these last 2 years have not, I think, have shown Rory in a much different light. Where, you know, for a while he was just Teflon. He couldn't touch him. And I think some of it's just getting a little bit old. You know, he's so opinionated on so much stuff, which is fine. He's got the right to do it. He's one of the best in the world, been there for a long time. But with that comes, you know, a lot of grief too. So I don't know. Just the tough guy act gets a little old.
Yeah, I agree. The whining, sort of the petulant child stuff's got to, he's got to let it go, because you look at the comment section of any story about Rory, and it used to be 80-20 positive, and now it's like 50-50. There are a lot of people that are turning on him, and I think, you know, you're such a big part of this game. He's got to stay above it.
I also think, like, going after Bones in the parking lot, like, yeah. I feel like if you are mad at a team that includes guys like, I don't know, Brooks Koepka is probably the best example, and you pick on like a skinny 58-year-old caddy, at like he's your target, that's a little bit like, look, I'm not, he's the guy who was there. Maybe he said something, maybe he didn't, who knows. Rory just wanted to be mad at someone. But Rory doesn't come off looking the toughest going after Bones as opposed to, you know, a professional athlete.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm getting Brooks's face.
Yeah, exactly.
Brooks won't hold back. Bones handled it like a gentleman.
He did. Mm-hmm. Craig, anything else on this? I think, you know, we've kind of hit it. We're all disappointed. It was an embarrassing performance. The guys didn't look like they wanted it very badly, and the results bore it out.
No, and I, to answer your earlier question, I wouldn't change a thing. I think that if you ask the groups, they wouldn't change a thing. I think for them, it's, man, this is the challenge. How do you put a team together that's mentally tough enough, has the, you know, the golf, you know, the structure of a team to go into enemy territory and, you know, fight all these different elements and come out on top. I think it's really hard to do, but I think a big part of this is how do any of these teams stack up and do that insurmountable challenge? So I don't think they would change it, right? I don't think, you know, I think they all want to be that team. Like, you all want to go in enemy territory and beat the crap out of the guys that someone told you that you don't have a chance against. So it kind of sucks until it does happen, but it'll happen. I mean, at some point.
Glenn, the last thing I have on this is there have been two. Is that right? It might just be one now. Away wins. Oh, no, it's two. Two away wins in the Ryder Cup in the last 20 years. You have Europe at Oakland Hills in 2004. And you have Europe at Medina in 2012. When's the next one happening?
That's a good question. I'd almost like to go back and watch some of the older Ryder Cups, because I think so much more goes into it than the mano a mano or the two on two. I think the fans are really injecting themselves into the sport now.
Mm-hmm.
Caddies are injecting themselves in the sport now, but mostly the fans. So I think it's hard. Like, you know, golfers aren't used to being called every name in the book going around a golf course. And golf's different than other sports. The fans can touch it. They're right there. Mm-hmm. So I think there's something to be said about what is the fan, live fan effect on the Ryder Cup, that you see such, you know, you'd never saw these before, but these such, you know, beatings, you know, by the home team. I think it's worth looking at. Is the fan behavior, I mean, it's interesting to ask the players, like, anonymously over the last 20, 30 years who have been there, what have you seen in the change in fans? Because, you know, with the social media and everything, everybody's so combative and everyone's so outspoken. And it's carrying over into the sports. And I keep going back to with gambling and everything. And I still say the biggest effect on sport is going to be when the first referee or player is killed by someone who lost a bet. So I think that there's a real danger here with the fans injecting themselves so much into it that it's affecting outcomes, and they know they can affect outcomes, and that's only going to encourage the home team to affect the outcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense. Well, we got 2 years till the next one. Hopefully the U.S. figures something out about how to win these and or you know, remembers whatever they forgot from Whistling Straits. Craig, you think it's time to talk a little football?
Let's do it.
Where do you want to start? I know you got some takes about the way Notre Dame Duke went, but
yeah, I mean, let's start with college. I mean, NFL is kind of is what it is, but college had a, it was a great college weekend. A lot of good games.
LSU Ole Miss was a incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, both teams, I think Ole Miss put up 700 yards. LSU put up like 600. I feel like, you know, we're always good for a game like that at some point in the SEC. Last year, it was particularly good when we got Alabama, Tennessee. But like, holy cow. Like, I was certain at the end of that game that Ole Miss had left too much time on the clock for LSU. And then they immediately allow like a 40-yard pass and then the horse collar on Jaden Daniels. And it's like, oh man, they're really messing this up. Ultimately not. It looks like that may end up being Lane Kiffin's, it's either his first, second, or third win that is likely to be over a team that ends up ranked. So maybe we're seeing Lane finally hit his turning point.
Which is crazy for a name that big in the coaching circles. Yeah. You'd think, you know, if you actually look at the record and the stats, it's crazy he's that well, you know, recognized. But that was good. You know, again, I think the Michigan saga is still exactly the same. They beat up on a team that they should have beaten up on. I think the two games of the week for me were Colorado and USC. I thought that was going to be an absolute blowout. And more than anything else, I just thought Colorado hung around and showed a lot of grit just to kind of stay in that game. That game could have easily been a 71-14 again and, you know, whatever. But they just kept fighting, kept coming back. And, again, they're missing some of their best players and, you know, just didn't quit. So I give them a ton of credit. They're getting better every week, you know, as far as a little bit of their discipline and, you know, figuring out this Division I high-paced, you know, big impact, you know, type of environment. So they're getting there. But the game of the week for me was Notre Dame Duke. You know, Notre Dame should have won that game. They are on paper and on physically, they, you know, they're just athletically, they're a better team. But we joked about this a little bit in the last podcast. Duke is no joke. They're a much better squad than they're getting credit for by a lot of the talking heads. And I know they're ranked now, and I don't know where they ended up after the loss, but I think they're still ranked.
To be clear, Duke was an undefeated top 20 team going into that game.
But it was one of those things where I think a lot of talking heads were still saying, yeah, hey, look, they're in the top 20, but they're Duke. They haven't really played anybody yet that was super – I mean, look, they won some big games, but everyone thought they were going to get smushed by Notre Dame.
Except the guys on College Game Day, all of whom picked Duke. Also, this is the same Duke team that beat Clemson by 3 touchdowns.
Like, yeah, this is a team you even in our last podcast were pretty confident that Notre Dame was going to beat this team. Yeah. I'm just saying, give Duke credit; they are a much better team than what anyone is really stacking them up for this year. With that said, they should have won that game or had a chance to win that game in the sense of. That little time on the clock, they pooch punt, give Notre Dame the ball back, and in the sense of now they're playing defensively. Like, it is the most historical thing in football where it's like, if you don't play to win, you're going to absolutely lose the game. And, you know, knowing this from all those years past with the Giants when they would do this, and every year they lost by a touchdown or a, you know, field goal at the end of the, you know, 1 second left on the clock. It was exactly the same scenario where, what are you doing? Go for it. Like, you've got all this momentum. You've got the ball. Put your foot on their throat and win this game. And they just didn't do it. And Notre Dame even got killed with a stupid call where the guy got pulled out of the game. The linebacker got pulled out of the game for spearing when he hit the guy in the hip with his helmet. I mean, it's the dumbest freaking rule in the world. And you're going to pull a guy out of the game. So it's bad enough you're going to give him a penalty. then you're going to pull a guy out of the game for that, like one of their best players, and in a really critical moment. They've got to figure out the targeting situation in college football, but that's for another day. All I'm saying is Notre Dame was on the ropes. If you lose that game, your season is kaput. Like, you guys don't have that runway anymore to, unfortunately, after that the loss last week. You got to run the table. But you won. That's all that matters. That's, at the end of the day, it's doesn't matter how you do it. You won. So
it was weird, man. And I was – when it was 4th-and-16 with, you know, about a minute left or under a minute left, and the entire season was on the line, I was not feeling good. Notre Dame was down 3 of its top 4 receivers, which I think showed in the game. You know, Sam Hartman had like 220 yards passing and 134 of them were to one tight end. So that's not the way they wanted the offense to work, obviously. But yeah, I was very nervous. I had friends texting me saying their entire opinion of Marcus Freeman as a coach rests on this drive. So thankfully they were able to drive down and punch it in. But yeah, you know, at the same time that Notre Dame probably should have lost that game based on the way the fourth quarter played out, Notre Dame never should have been in a close game based on the way the first half played out. Like, Duke didn't score. Notre Dame missed a field goal and shot themselves in the foot a number of times in the first half. They were surprisingly conservative in their play calling, particularly punting in Duke territory multiple times. So Notre Dame should have had, they had a 10-0 lead at halftime. They should have been up 24-0 and it never should have been a problem. So, you know, Duke is good. Riley Leonard's a terrific quarterback. I don't know about all this first round stuff that people are talking about him, but that's a different question. But hey, at the end of the day, Notre Dame went on the road, played a ranked undefeated team, and did not just win, but covered. And it was ugly, but I don't know what more you could ask for.
I know what you could ask for. You could beat the crap out of Duke, for crying out loud. You're Notre Dame touting this that you're a top 5 team technically in your head.
No one's beating the crap out of Duke.
What?
No one's beating the crap out of Duke. Notre Dame's the only team that's beaten Duke.
No, you should have beaten the crap out of Duke. That's what I'm saying. Like, if you said, what else can you say?
We don't know if it's possible to beat the crap out of Duke.
Oh, sure it is.
No one's done it. Look, Craig, bottom line, like, Mike Elko is a phenomenal football coach. There is a reason that he was a really sought after defensive coordinator. There's a reason that he was the highest paid assistant in the country when he left Notre Dame to go to Texas A&M. There is a reason that Duke wanted him. It is particularly impressive that he won them 9 games last year. I don't think they've lost a game by more than one score in the last 2 years. They haven't. Their losses last year were by 2, 3, 3, and 8. Like, that's where this team stands. So I'm not just like joking when I say we don't know if it's possible to beat the crap out of Duke. Like, teams aren't doing it. Like, Mike Elko, Duke's not always going to put up a ton of points. Sometimes, you know, they're going to score 14 or they're going to score 20 and they're going to lose. And that's what happened last week. But like, you have to take their defense seriously, and their defense has kept them in every single one of the last 18 games they've played under Mike Elko. And that's like a real thing.
Well, it would have been nice. Well, that's all I'm saying.
Well, Notre Dame has another chance to go on the road and play a night game on national TV against a ranked undefeated opponent this week when they go to Louisville. So maybe they'll beat the crap out of them.
Do you want to have Danny Jones as your quarterback? He does great in prime
time. Danny Jones can be my quarterback when Notre Dame's on the road. You just can't let him play at home. That's how it seems like it works.
At home, at night, on Thursdays, maybe Tuesdays, we'll throw into that just because we don't know any better. Yeah, there's a lot we can't do right now. We're a disaster. Absolute disaster.
Craig, before we get to the bad NFL stuff that there is to discuss with your team, we should get to the good NFL stuff that there is to discuss with Glenn's team. Glenn, with every passing week in the NFL, I struggle more and more to figure out who's good.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bills made that significantly harder this past weekend when they smacked the Dolphins 48-20.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, we've made a lot on this podcast about the Bills and them losing to bad teams and Josh Allen making bad decisions. And, you know, is it possible that he can't succeed in the absence of Brian Daboll and all this stuff? I felt like the Bills put a lot of my doubts to bed this past weekend.
As they could, when you have Josh Allen throwing more touchdowns than incomplete passes.
That's pretty good.
And I think the stat I saw, which is pretty impressive, over the last, I think, 3 weeks, he's, you know, 77 for 93, something like that. But he's only had 6 off-target passes in 3 weeks, which is kind of amazing stat. I didn't even know they kept that stat. But I was like, wow. I want everybody to go back to doubting the Bills. I want us back under the radar. We're not the Chiefs, the Dolphins. Dolphins and the Jets have the division. The Bills might be in the basement. I want to go back to that because all that talk, like the window's closed on the Bills. I've said a million times, as long as we have 17, that window is wide open. That window is not closing.
It's and you get Vaughn Miller back soon?
What's that?
You get Vaughn Miller back soon?
Vaughn is he's in London, and he's practiced this week. So big loss. We lost Trey White with an Achilles late in the game too, which is a bummer, non-contact. So poor guy worked hard to get back at the end of last year and was playing great this year. That's a huge loss, but, you know, it's football. And that defense is playing as good as the offense. I mean, I knew it was going to be back and forth, and it felt like whichever team breaks serve first is going to win, and the Bills did. But then they went on just to, I think, you know, whatever scheme Sean McDermott came up, I think it had Tua confused. I think they didn't know where to go. You know, he held Tyreek Hill again to like 60 yards. I don't think he's ever had a big game against the Bills, especially as a Dolphin. He's made some big plays, but they kept him in check. They kept Waddle in check, and they had Tua on the run. And we finally have a pass rush. We have a defense, you know, a head coach now, the defensive coordinator calling blitzes, which we've never done. So I like where we are. Although 2 years ago when they were rolling through the NFL, they went to Jacksonville and laid an egg, lost to Trevor Lawrence, and we've got Jacksonville on Sunday morning from London. So we'll see how they go. And then they've got the mighty Giants the week after on Sunday night.
Well, if Miami was ever looking to regain momentum, playing the Giants is definitely the way to go. So like, they could be back in that 70-point category real quick.
I think the Giants' defense, the offensive line, it's just the Giants' offensive line. You got to give Daniel Jones some time, 11 sacks.
Yeah.
He had to be seeing ghosts. He had to have like a Sam Darnold night. He had to be seeing ghosts out there.
But so I was on that Daniel Jones train for a long time. And I do like the guy. I hope he does well in life. I think he's a stand-up dude and really want him to succeed as a quarterback.
There's a big butt coming here.
There's a huge butt. My issue with him that he still hasn't gotten better with is he holds the ball on too long and he makes dumb decisions in really critical times. Those things haven't gotten better. That's my biggest problem with Daniel Jones. And when your offensive line isn't great, those are the things that hurt you the most, because those extra 2 seconds, instead of stepping into the pocket and letting it fly, he's holding on and trying to do something special. He's getting sacked or he's turning the ball over. So out of those 11 sacks, I think you watch the Dan Orlovsky breakdown of his whole game, I think 6 of those were technically Daniel's fault. Where he could have gotten rid of the ball faster. He had outlets. He's looking the wrong way. He's, you know, reading things wrong, or he's not, you know, reading things fast enough. So in reality, the offensive line sucks. But Daniel's got to play better. Like, if you're a $40 million quarterback, you can't play like it's your first time out on the football field. And that's kind of what he did last week. It was by far one of his worst games as a starter. So uber frustrating, and it's just, he does have all these weapons now at his disposal, even without Saquon. and we're just not able to utilize any of him because he's not making a lot of the right plays. So, yes, the offensive line is not helping, and he may be concussed for 5 weeks straight. I don't know. Maybe that's why he's holding the ball too long and things look a little screwy. But in reality, so he does need to take ownership of some of this stuff. I mean, one of the things, too, that's like, you know, they're running the ball on third and long, and, you know, they come off play, and they're like, what are you doing calling a run play there? And he's like, I heard the play wrong. I'm like, well, do you have the right to change those? And he's like, yes, I heard the play wrong, and I didn't change it in the huddle. So it's like there's a big disconnect now between who's calling the plays, how they're getting in, what the whole concept is. They're just from ownership to leaders to coaches to players right now, there is a big disconnect, and it's not going to get fixed overnight. I'm almost in the boat, to be totally honest. Go get yourself a good draft pick next year, because this year is just – I don't know how to fix this year fast enough, unless they get you know, Collins off free agency and throw him in the offensive line, and they move they shuffle around some of their offensive linemen and figure, you know, they put Pugh, who they just signed at guard, they get Thomas back. Maybe they can scrounge up something, but if they can't, you know, figure out what you want to do next year and grab a top five pick, because. I don't know. To come back and be mediocre again just sucks. We've been mediocre for, you know, 15 years now.
I noticed Evan Neal made himself a big target of
New York sports radio talk show hosts. Those are the guys that are paying your tickets. They're paying your salary, right? Like, living in New York is expensive enough. Now you're paying, you know, a couple hundred bucks per game, and you're paying $50 just to park your damn car in one of the worst parking lots in – you know, the history of NFL, and this jackass is saying, you know, well, at least I'm not flipping burgers or whatever the heck he said. It's just, you can't do that. I mean, I get it. He's frustrated, and I shouldn't call him a jackass. I don't know the guy. He's probably a great dude, but you can't say that stuff to your fans. You can't. It's just not, it's not right. It's not a good way to handle it by any means, you know? So we'll see. There's a lot of things the Giants need to shake out. You got to be smarter. You got to play better. Winning fixes everything. I just don't know if they can do that anytime soon. Going against Miami and the Bills in the next two games doesn't seem like a remedy for success either. So
I mean, Miami loves to give up points, and the Giants score on average they score 1.5 points per game at home, but they score 20 points per game on the road, which is like a lot better.
Yeah.
So you're going to Miami, they have a bad defense, you're going on the road. Like, are we going to see the Giants put up like 42 points?
I don't know. First things first, they got to get healthy and then go from there. It's hard to judge even what this team is with, you know, all these key injuries to their, but I feel like, it's getting worse. We just lost our center too. So it's not getting, we're not getting healthier. I feel like we're losing more and more bodies. So I don't know. It's going to be an interesting season.
That much is for sure. Glenn, any parting shots before we wrap this thing up? Any takeaways from the Morris County event?
Oh, Craig called me jackass like 20 times during the Morris County event. And I was like, I shouldn't call Evan Neal a jackass. He called me jackass.
Yeah, but I know you. I don't know Evan Neal. I shouldn't say that about somebody I don't know. You, I know. It's Max.
There you go. That Morris County event was awesome. That's, you know, 125-year-old golf course. Conditions were perfect. Really hard greens. Great mix of short and long holes. That was a good one. We had to end up with a good turnout. The food was great. Staff was great. Can't say enough about that place.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. October can be, you know, it's great golf up here when the weather's good, but man, you can get some wet and cold days as well. We had a absolute perfect day.
It was hot, like 84 degrees.
Yep.
Craig, you wanna give the people any sneak peek of what season 3 of One Club Short is gonna look like, or is the answer just stay tuned?
Yeah, stay tuned. We're gonna change it up. We're actually talking about a lot of different things. Do two different kind of series. But there's a lot to be ironed out. So I think it's way too early to start kind of talking about it or, you know, dipping into that. But with that being said, it's I think it's going to be really exciting 2024. So
love it. Well, as always, people can find all the news they want on One Club Short at oneclubshort.com. You can also follow us on Instagram, where we're at One Club Short, and on Twitter, where we're at One Club Short, and then the number one. Podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts, with video if you're listening on Spotify. And you can, of course, see the entire podcast on YouTube as well, where we're at One Club Short Pod. Well, guys, I enjoyed this a lot more than I enjoyed watching the Ryder Cup, and it was a lot less stressful than Notre Dame Duke, too. So that's 2 points for this podcast. We'll do it again, similar time, similar place next week. Until then, thanks everyone for listening.
Thanks, everybody.